Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
ISIL must cease to have any safe haven in Syria.
The Prime Minister has introduced his motion to extend the mission against ISIS by a year and expand it into Syria. The opposition is heavily criticizing the move. To make the argument for action in Syria, we're joined by McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru.
On Monday, the Prime Minister met with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg to discuss international security issues, including the conflict in Ukraine. Paul Wells sits down with Stoltenberg to discuss Canada's role in helping Ukraine defend itself from Russian aggressions.
Left-leaning Canadians gathered in Ottawa for this year's Progress Summit. To discuss the state of progressive politics in Canada today, Aaron sits down with Ed Broadbent, the former leader of the New Democrats and the founder of the Broadbent Institute.
And the McLean's panel discusses new budgets in Alberta and Quebec, as well as the domestic politics of the war on ISIS.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
ISIL must be resisted and resisted by force.
That's Prime Minister Stephen Harper as he unveiled the government's motion to extend and expand the mission against ISIS. The government plans to continue the mission until March 30th of next year, and it will expand the airstrikes to include Syria on top of Iraq. Prime Minister Stephen Harper says this is necessary to battle the terrorist group.
But the opposition is unconvinced. Liberal leader Justin Trudeau says Canadians were misled about this mission.
In the fall, we expressed grave concern that the Prime Minister intended to involve Canada in a longer, deeper combat engagement than he was leading this House to believe at the time. Today, with their motion, we know those concerns were well-founded. We will not support this government's decision to deepen this combat mission and expand it into Syria.
And it is that expansion that also has NDP leader Thomas Mulcair angry. He says this is essentially creating an alliance with the violent regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
This is a regime that continues to commit the most atrocious war crimes. A regime that not only uses chemical weapons on civilians, it uses snipers against women and children. A regime that actually collaborated with ISIS, Mr. Speaker. It's hard to believe the Prime Minister when he says the mission is about preventing atrocities, when he's willing to work with one of the worst perpetrators of atrocities in the world today.
The New Democrats and Liberals are also questioning if the government's move to enter Syria breaches international law.
McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru was on the ground in northern Iraq after the mission began and had the chance to see the front lines but also speak with displaced Iraqis and Syrian refugees. He's written an article disputing some of the arguments from those that feel we should not be going into Syria. He joins us now on the show. All right, so Michael, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your article was more a response to a Globe and Mail editorial that said it wasn't right to go into Syria, but nonetheless, it touches on a lot of the arguments from the opposition parties. So first off, I guess, can you explain why you think it's necessary that Canada go into Syria?
I think there's two main reasons. The first is practical. We decided last year to enter into a military engagement against Islamic State in Iraq. But the border, as far as Islamic State is concerned, between Iraq and Syria is meaningless. They have their stronghold in many ways in Syria, their so-called capital, as Prime Minister Harper pointed out, in Raqqa. For them, the border doesn't exist. They symbolically bulldozed a lot of the sand beams separating the two countries. So it never really made a whole lot of practical sense only to hit Islamic State in half the territory that they control, because they always would have been able to retreat back into Syria. So I think there's that practical argument. If we're going to be committed to degrading and destroying or containing Islamic State, then I think we need to allow ourselves the ability to hit them everywhere. The second reason, and this relates to why I supported our original mission, which was limited to Iraq, although the same reasons apply to Syria, and that is the more of a moral sense of international solidarity. Islamic State is and has attempted to commit genocide against the Yazidis, for example. They revel in their slavery, their extreme Islamic supremacism, which they direct against many other Muslims. as well. I think that if we are committed to stopping genocide, I think we have to be clear-eyed about the fact that that in some cases involves force. And again, let me give a very specific example. When the Yazidis were trapped on Mount Sinjar, they, in other places, they would have been wiped out. This is an ancient religion, a peaceful one, that would have been wiped out if they were not freed, in part, through military force. So if we're going to argue that we are not willing to employ military force against Islamic State, we at least owe it to ourselves to be upfront about what that entails. And that entails subjecting the people of Syria and Iraq to further mass rape and further mass murder. And I just don't think that that's the sort of decision that I'm comfortable with. And I don't think other Canadians should be comfortable with it either.
So the opposition is arguing as well that this is an alliance of sorts with the Assad regime, that this would basically support the Assad regime by attacking ISIS. Do you agree with that statement?
I don't accept that at all. Since the very beginnings of the uprising against him, Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad has tried to portray all opposition to him as Al-Qaeda, as Islamist extremism. That was never the case. There was a wide and deep democratic streak in the Syrian revolution. But he's contributed and he's worked towards making this so. And let's not forget some of the early alliances that the Bashar al-Assad's regime did have with jihadists. During the American occupation of Iraq and the insurgency against the United States there, the rat lines of jihadists traversing Syria were unmolested by Assad. He is familiar with Islamist jihadists. He released many of them from jail when the Syrian revolution began. And now he and Islamic State, they share the common short-term goal of eliminating Syria's non-jihadist opposition. I believe the Globe and Mail described them as main adversaries. If that were true, then all parties in any war should wish to be so lucky. Bashar al-Assad, as his air force is quite happy and quite active, dropping barrel bombs on Syrian school children. He doesn't drop a whole lot of bombs on Islamic State. Similarly, from the other side, Islamic State's casualties, their fighters, are killed mostly in engagements with revolutionary Kurds. They're not suffering at the hands of Assad, and Assad's not suffering at the hands of Islamic State. So they're not the two main proponents of the civil war, and for the most part, they leave each other molested at the moment because they share this short-term, I suppose, convergence of interests in eliminating the non-jihadist opposition. So I don't accept that that it's one or the other. I don't accept that they're main adversaries. But further to that, I would say that, again, we look back to the Second World War. We, of course, were fighting the Nazis, as was the Soviet dictatorship of Joseph Stalin. That doesn't taint us with all the sins of Soviet communism. And similarly here, hitting Islamic State doesn't taint us with the sins of Assad.
What about international law? It's one of the arguments being brought up by the opposition, saying that this action in Syria, since the Canadian government is not seeking the direct consent from the Syrian government, that this may be breaching international law. Does that argument fly?
Well, I'm not an international lawyer, so I can't speak to the details of that. But again, we should be clear-eyed about what we're talking about here. Seeking Security Council approval, for example, means outsourcing Canada's foreign policy to the dictatorship of or this quasi-dictatorship of Vladimir Putin. I'm not comfortable with that. Putin has a veto on the UN Security Council, and he's one of the main armors of Bashar al-Assad. I mean, it's just not a serious moral argument to say we can't operate without the approval of the Russian president, who is bankrolling and arming the Syrian dictator. It's not, again, there are legal technicalities here, which I'm upfront that I'm not equipped to deal with. I just don't see that as a serious moral argument.
Will our troops face more risks by going into Syria? Are we walking into the lion's den? Because there's a civil war going on, and we know that the Assad regime, as you mentioned, has brutal tactics on its own, in addition to what ISIS is doing. So is there more risk involved for our pilots and our planes if they go into Syria as opposed to what they're already dealing with in northern Iraq?
I think the biggest risk, and I'm not a military person, so again, I'm speculating here, but I think the biggest risk, of course, is losing a pilot and having a pilot captured. And if you look at the map, one can speculate that it, in terms of search and rescue and recovery, that there are farther distances to go if those pilots are operating over Syrian territory than if they're operating along the borders of Islamic State and the Peshmerga in Iraq. I suspect, again, I don't know, I suspect that is a heightened risk. But again, that's speculation on my part. I in terms of, we're not going to have people on the ground in Syria, so in terms of firefights, I don't really see a material difference towards our ground soldiers now that we are presumably going to expand this into Syria.
Part of the opposition to this mission is that the presentation by the government is basically mission creep, that they just said, no, we're only just going to send some people over there to check things out. Then it became, no, we're going to send some planes over as well as having advisors on the ground helping forces. Now we're going into Syria. Is that an argument that you see, like, from the start of this mission to now, as opposed to what we saw with Afghanistan, let's say, where it's pretty clear we were going in there and we were going to war? Now it's being framed in a different way. So in your eyes, has this been mission creep?
I think the opposition has been right to criticize the government for a certain lack of transparency and verbal fudging in terms of what we're doing there. I think that we are involved in ground combat. I think there was certainly some misleading or dishonest statements, or at least inaccurate statements about that. And the mission has obviously expanded. I suppose expand is another word for creep. But in terms of are we looking at something like Afghanistan? I don't know. It's possible. I don't think Islamic State is going to be defeated in a year. The difference, I think, is I just don't see any. I can't foresee any possibility that Canada would deploy anything like the number of troops in Iraq or Syria that we did in Afghanistan. We have about 69, I believe, is the last count in northern Iraq. These are special operations folks doing mostly advising and assisting. Again, although we do know that they have been exposed to and involved in some combat, I can't foresee any sort of similar mission in Syria, although something very, very limited with the Kurds is possible. But the sort of battalion level deployment that we saw in Afghanistan, I just don't see that being in the foreseeable future. So I don't think that comparison is valid to the full extent at the moment.
So it's not going to take another year to wipe out ISIS, or at least degrade them to the point where this mission would be done. Afghanistan lasted 12 years, and you're saying you don't see it hitting the scale that we had. So how long do you think this could last?
I think it depends on the resolve and how much the Western coalition wants to commit to it. I think it depends on the capability of the Iraqi security forces and the Kurdish Peshmerga in Iraq. Syria, it depends on all kinds of things, because there are numerous factions in there besides Islamic State. Look, I mean, if the United States wanted to, capture Raqqa, they could do it in several weeks, if not sooner. But they don't want to. They're not willing to commit the number of troops. They don't want to put their folks on the ground. American President Obama talked about degrade and eventually destroy. I think what's unspoken is a certain perhaps leaning towards containment. So, I mean, that's the sort of thing that can go on for a very long time. I'm not sure that's a wise idea. I think that one of Islamic State's pillars of legitimacy, certainly when it portrays itself to potential recruits outside Syria, is that it has territory. It has recreated the caliphate, as it puts it. So I do think that there is a an argument, a good argument, that we should want to shrink and shrink and shrink the territory that Islamic State controls. But I mean, let's be frank. I mean, the Americans are committing more, but nothing like what they had in Afghanistan. We have six combat planes, so this is a small mission. This is not the sort of all-out war where territory is rolled over and cities are sacked and countries are captured. It's restrained, and that's the sort of thing that can last a long time.
That was McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru discussing the mission against ISIS and the government's plan to expand it into Syria. To read more of what Michael has to say on the mission, go to mcleans.ca.
On Monday, Prime Minister Stephen Harper sat down with NATO's Secretary General to discuss, among other things, the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Canada is part of the NATO mission Operation Reassurance, which is aimed at protecting member countries such as Poland and Lithuania from Russian aggression. NATO allies have also been helping Ukraine in its struggle, and Canada has supplied its military with non-lethal equipment. But there has also been talk of increasing the help to include weaponry. To talk more about the conflict and what Canada and NATO can do to help, McLean's political editor Paul Wells was able to sit down with the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg.
In Europe, the response since Russia started being active in eastern Ukraine has been to draw a thicker line around NATO. Ukraine's outside that line. There's a big debate now about providing lethal assistance to the Ukrainian government. Is that something that you would advise? Is that something that you would countenance? Isn't it full of risk?
NATO's main responsibility and core task, the reason why the alliance was founded, was to provide security to all allies, to all nations within the alliance.
Yes,
and that's still our core task. So therefore, my main responsibility is to make sure that that we keep NATO strong, and that we have collective defense for the 21st century, meeting new types of challenges.
Yes.
So you are right. So the main responsibility of NATO is to make sure that anyone who considers attacking any NATO ally should know that if one ally is attacked, the attack will not meet one but 28 allies. Mm-hmm. Every nation has the right to defend itself. Mm-hmm. That also includes, of course, Ukraine. But it's up to the different allies to decide on the question of provision of weapons equipment to Ukraine. It's not something that NATO is going to decide.
Okay. So Canada has just given Ukraine night vision goggles to monitor the ceasefire. Although night vision goggles are also handy in combat. If Canada sent tanks next week, would you have a response?
Also, I will leave. Also, it's up to Canada to decide. Ukraine is a sovereign, independent country. Mm-hmm. Ukraine has the right to defend itself. But again, it's not NATO. Also, NATO, we have different roles to play. Mm-hmm. Our role is we are playing our part, protecting all allies, helping Ukraine, supporting Ukraine. But when it comes to equipment, that's not on our table.
NATO's position is delicate here because there are all kinds of independent observers in civil society. Some are sympathetic with Russia and think that NATO has expanded too far, too fast. Others are impatient and think that NATO and NATO member states aren't doing enough to help Ukraine. Let me put those two arguments to you in sequence. First, I'm quoting here Peter Hitchens in the Spectator magazine, who's a vocal defender of Russia's side on this. He writes, "Two great land powers face each other. One of these powers, Russia, has given up control over 700,000 square miles of valuable territory. The other, the European Union, has gained control over 400,000 of those square miles. Which of these powers is expanding?" His argument is essentially that Russia is the victim.
I think that's a completely wrong statement, because it builds on the idea of spheres of influence. or that in a way it's the European Union or NATO that is expanding eastwards. It's independent nations which have knocked on the door and wanted membership. Mm-hmm. It's not NATO in a way moving east, but it's east wanting to join NATO or the European Union. And that's the sovereign right of every sovereign nation to decide. So just the idea that this is something which is lost for Russia and gained by the European Union is a wrong concept. And this is the wrong concept based on the idea that we are sovereign nations living together at the Euro-Asiatic continent, and we should respect decisions by sovereign nations. This is every nation has the right to decide its own path, including what kind of security arrangement it will be part of. Mm-hmm. This is a fundamental principle. It's enshrined, for instance, in the Helsinki Final Act, which also Russia has subscribed to. So, no one has been forced to become a member of the European Union or NATO. Everyone that has joined the European Union and NATO has joined because their own free democratic will.
So then on the other side of the debate, there are those who say that if NATO wants to show that it's serious, it should extend membership to Georgia and Ukraine. How would you answer that?
That we are still standing up for the open door policy. The open door policy is enshrined in the Washington Treaty. It's part of the founding act for the alliance. When it comes to Georgia, we have a very substantial package, substantial cooperation going on with them. Mm-hmm. We are establishing a training center and we're working with Georgia to enable them to move forward on the path towards membership. Ukraine, well, some years ago they applied for membership, then I respected them. Then they decided to be a non-bloc country. Now they have started a process of reforming with the aim to apply for a membership later on. If and when they apply, well, then we will assess that application in the exactly the same way as we have assessed any other application for joining NATO.
Okay. How likely is Ukraine to get into NATO? It's got an occupying army on its territory.
It will be wrong of me to speculate. Ukraine has, I respect what they have announced now, that they will start the process of reforming, aiming at applying later on. They have underlined themselves that this will take some time. So we have to assess that when and if they apply.
That was NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg speaking with Maclean's political editor, Paul Wells.
Still to come on the show, we speak with former NDP leader Ed Broadbent about the state of progressive politics in Canada, and the Maclean's panel discusses budget season and the domestic politics of fighting ISIS. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, the Maclean's panel looks at the politics of fighting ISIS and the wait for the federal budget. But first, this weekend, left-leaning Canadians gathered in Ottawa for the 2015 Progress Summit. It's organized by the Broadbent Institute and is meant to highlight progressive policies to move the country forward and train people to become the leaders of tomorrow. This year's summit featured many speakers, including NDP leader Thomas Mulcair, who used the opportunity to unveil one of the policies he'll be running on in the next election.
Today, I'm pleased to announce that a new Democratic government will commit to reducing income inequality and renew Canada's commitment to the elimination of child poverty. To assist in achieving these goals, we will close the tax loophole currently enjoyed by CEOs on stock options and redirect that money to low-income families through an enhanced working income tax benefit and an enhanced child benefit supplement. This will be a dollar for dollar transfer in benefits from those who need it the least to those who need it the most.
As always, one of the key speakers for the event is the founder of the Broadbent Institute, former federal New Democrat leader Ed Broadbent. I was able to meet up with him at the summit, and we spoke about the state of progressive politics in Canada.
So, Ed, I guess, first of all, you know, how do you look at this election coming up? Is there a big opening here for progressive policies with the Conservatives kind of down in the polls?
Absolutely. I mean, and put it in historical perspective, you know, we compare with the NDP, we're there now, with Tom Mulcair as leader, compared to even when Jack was there. I mean, Jack had the hopes of becoming, you know, one day the official opposition. And it came a little sooner than he expected even, but it happened. For the first time in history, the NDP can plausibly talk about forming a government. So, and we do know from all kinds of public surveys that the people of Canada are basically progressive in their attitudes towards government and social policy. And so the task for the NDP and Tom Mulcair in the election is to move those polls where they are now into a governing possibility mandate. And we do know that campaigns change a lot. The last election was a good example. A few weeks before the voting day, no one expected the NDP to have the breakthrough they did, but then very rapidly there was change. So there's an opportunity to seize upon a malfunctioning economy, deepening of inequality, concerns about the environment, foreign policy, a lot of issues that make it possible for the NDP to do very well.
How do you think people, or how do you think, you know, you and political actors, like how real do you think the possibilities of a coalition government, how do you think that would work? And would that be a victory in itself for progressive politics? Or in your mind, is if to advance progressive politics, do we need an NDP government?
Well, I think, first of all, in general, I think it's a mug's game to speculate about the future. But I say now what I always said in the past when I was there as an active politician. The responsibility of all the leaders is to look at what the people of Canada decide. If they give somebody a majority, which I frankly think right now is not something we'll forecast, then they have to look at how they make Parliament work, how they not sit down and say, oh, well, we don't have a majority, I guess we just go back and hide in your closet or something. They have to literally make Parliament work. And I think unquestionably there would be serious discussions among the parties about how different forms in our parliamentary system you can put configurations together to form a government. But I'm not going to say what they will be. I think that it's up to the NDP right now, which it's doing on the minimum wage, it's doing on child care, it's doing in its opposition to C-40-51, that to show they are the progressive voice for Canadians, and then see what Canadians decide.
How, once a progressive government comes in, and you know, and eventually, presumably, some other party than the Conservative Party will be the government, it seems to me that there is, in general, within the population, a mistrust of government, a reluctance to, you know, commit more tax dollars to a government for programs, and just a general mistrust that government can do things, which to me seems like the sort of thing progressives need. They need a certain amount of trust in government to accomplish their goals. How, you know, if a progressive party is in government, what can they do, or what should they do, to sort of counteract that? Like, how can they win trust back for government?
I think there is amongst Canadians, as indeed there is all over the Western world, a distrust of big institutions, not just government, corporations, the church, unions, traditional institutions of leadership are being challenged by a fair amount of distrust. So I think from a point of view of a party like the NDP, it's really very important when they're talking about a public enterprise, for example, involving more government involvement, is to show they're doing it for concrete reasons that to meet a problem, not abstractly. I often mention that when Tommy Douglas brought in Medicare, it wasn't because he sat down and said, oh, what can we get government to do today out of the blue? Medicare was brought in to solve a practical problem. It was seen to be the most effective and fair way of providing health services to Canadians. So I say, take something like Mr. Mulcair is advocating today, which is publicly funded childcare. You explain why it makes sense for the government to do it, how it can bring in a lower cost, a much lower cost, a system of childcare that meets real family needs, especially but not exclusively women who want to have the choice of staying at home or joining the labor market. So show why this would work and show, for example, based on Quebec, when they brought it in, more women went in the labor market, they earned money, they paid taxes, and eventually it became self-financing in effect. So a party of the progressive side of the ledger facing skepticism about government, I think simply has to be clear why it wants to do something and why government in particular, in a given instance, would be the best thing, practical thing that would work, and not simply because you think it's a good idea for governments to do things.
How does it seems to me the Conservative Party has been very successful at defining the terms of the conversation in terms of taxes, in terms of, you know, what government's there for, in terms of, you know, how much revenue government should have. Do progressives need to start, and maybe even a government would be the best position to do that, to expand the conversation about what government can do and you know, not just implementing programs, but talking, you know, more generally about, you know, a government as a force for good?
I think that's the case, and they have to talk about the scourge of Canada, as it is many countries right now, growing inequality. And if you want the government to do something about it by changing all these highly beneficial tax giveaways to upper income people, for example, to talk about, again, inequality, the damage it does to children in terms of their expectations. Poor kids, low-income kids, for example, can't afford hockey equipment normally. A very high percentage of families can't afford to buy all the equipment and do all the hustling that families do to take their kids to regular competitive children's hockey. It's impossible for them. So I think to talk about inequality and how absurd and unfair this is for so many families, and that's why we want to do something about it, not just attack the rich, for example, but how we might want to remove certain loopholes in a tax system to make a country that is genuinely one of opportunity for all our kids. So you tie into a value that all Canadians have. All Canadians do value the idea that any child should be able to be whatever he or she has talents to do. So I think you link it with Canadian values, make a practical case, and more often than not, I think Canadians will accept innovation by the government.
That was Ed Broadbent, the founder of the Broadbent Institute and the former leader of the federal NDP.
Coming up on the show, the Maclean's panel discusses budget season and the domestic politics around the mission against ISIS. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill.
It's now time for the Maclean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined by Maclean's political editor, Paul Wells, as well as Maclean's associate editor, Aaron Wary. Thanks very much for joining me here. Okay, so first off, we're going to discuss budgets. This week we had two provincial budgets, Alberta and Quebec. Alberta surprising a lot of people by increasing many fees and taxes, which some would say is not Albertan at all. But nonetheless, that's what Prentice has done. Premier Prentice has done while dealing with, you know, low oil prices and a lot of economic difficulties there. But the opposition is now saying, well, we've got it from Alberta. Why can't we get one from the federal government? So, Paul, what's your take on these provincial budgets? What can we read into them? And where is the federal budget?
Really important and politically risky budgets, both for the government of Philippe Couillard in Quebec and for Prentice in Alberta. I think we saw Prentice flinch a bit. I think we saw the return of the timid Jim Prentice that we all knew in Ottawa, and the bold Jim Prentice who crushes his enemies, who's been the Premier of Alberta for the last few months, didn't show up for this budget. Fairly modest spending cuts, more than 50 little niggling tax and fee increases rather than the introduction of a provincial sales tax or something bold and unprecedented, and a deficit that's going to stick around for a few years. So a lot of pain, a lot of sacrifices that Albertans will be able to recognize, and still only modest benefits and really no change at all to the sort of structure of the Alberta economy. So that's a bit of a surprise. From Couillard, something much bolder, and we'll see whether the situation in Quebec has been that the population has basically been behind this clumsy new government. The opposition's going crazy, but the population understands that there has to be some sacrifices made to balance budget. And then the question comes up, look, if these guys can table budgets, why can't Stephen Harper and Joe Oliver? And we can't find Joe Oliver right now with teams of bloodhounds, so it's kind of hard to ask him that question. It's getting close to the time when he would have to announce a budget, if there's even going to be one in April. Maybe there'll be one in May. There are former bureaucrats who've written analysis suggesting that maybe there won't be a budget at all. I thought that was ridiculous when they wrote it, but the question is starting to pose itself.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, eh? Because they could conceivably not table a budget. You don't necessarily need a budget. You can just pass estimates and appropriation bills. If you told me 2 months ago that budget timing would be an issue, even when they announced that they were going to delay the budget, I wouldn't have thought that it would be an issue. I just didn't think it would have mattered, sort of in the popular opinion way. Now I'm starting to wonder whether they're getting to a point where this starts to look silly, and the opposition is starting to come after the government to say, where is Joe Oliver? He hasn't spoken in the House since I think March 10th. Obviously, there's been a couple weeks off, but he wasn't in the House this week. These things start to pile up, and I think it also starts to put more pressure on the budget itself. If you're going to wait long, it better be a really interesting and good budget, because if it comes out and it's, you know, sort of things we already knew they were going to do, or it's not really anything novel, it suddenly starts to see, the question then becomes, you know, why did we wait this long? What was the point?
Well, I couldn't see the government passing up the opportunity to have the PR event of balancing the books as well, something they've been talking about since the recession began. Now let's take a look at the mission in Iraq, which may soon be expanding to Syria and extending for another year. That's going to happen with a majority government, despite this motion before Parliament. But specifically the politics, the domestic politics of it all, the Liberals and the NDP are both opposing this motion. I was speaking with a Conservative recently who said they were very surprised to see the Liberals actually continue their opposition to this. They thought they were going to flip and actually support it and possibly use something like the terror attack to say things have changed since we first had this vote. Were you surprised to see the Liberals continue their opposition to this?
A little bit. I had a random Liberal MP, and there aren't many of them, come up to me on Metcalf Street the other day and ask, you know, what do you think we're going to do? And so it was plainly a subject of some conversation within the Liberal caucus, whether they were going to support the extension or oppose it the way they had opposed the original mission. It makes sense in retrospect. Increasingly, it seems that when Justin Trudeau finds himself in hot water, or at least in controversy over one of his decisions, his instinct is to dig in and to insist that no, he meant to do it. What everyone was saying was a gaffe was not a gaffe. What everyone was saying was a mistake. So whether it's on the prospect of having pro-life candidates in the party, or on the niqab covering in citizenship ceremonies and on and on and on. Whenever someone pushes back, unlike, I have to say, the case with Michael Ignatieff, who, if you pushed him, he tended to step back. Trudeau tends to lean forward. And so his decision to continue opposing this mission, I still think it's wrong-headed. I still think the military deployment fits in with what most of Canada's allies are doing. But he's happy to hear me say it's wrong-headed. He's going to continue opposing it anyway.
Aaron, some polls, recent polls show that support is softening. It's still a majority of Canadians who support the mission, but it's not as much as before. Do you think that that played into the decision at all?
It's possible, and the Liberals may have had some sense that this was the way things are going. I think Paul's probably right, though, that the Liberals looked at it and said, well, we're better off sort of doubling down on what our position was. It's interesting. I think there's sort of, if you look at sort of Trudeau and Harper on this, Trudeau is trying very hard to be serious now. If my understanding this week was that he'll be speaking again during the debate in the House over the mission, I think that's supposed to happen next week still. I still think there's a major onus on Trudeau to explain how his approach makes any sense here. On the other hand, Harper, I think, I don't think people quite appreciated what was happening in the moment. His decision to joke about whether or not the war was legal and we needed to notify the United Nations, I think, was a massive blunder on his part. And so he is now in the role, he's now in the place that, to me, where Trudeau was 6 months ago making jokes about war. I think Harper's now suddenly in a bit of a weird spot. And I think with that, with the polls that you referred to and the softening support, this isn't quite the slam dunk that it maybe seemed like it was. I don't know whether the Canadian public's is feeling as comfortable about this war as maybe we thought they were. And now we get to see how it all plays out. And if the public isn't maybe quite sure about this, then suddenly it becomes that much more important to see how it plays out. So I think it's interesting how these two leaders are kind of moving at this point. And I'm very interested to see where Trudeau goes sort of next week on this issue.
It's an obvious wedge issue that the government has the most support of Canadians at the moment. But could that dramatically shift if a Canadian soldier, let's say, is killed while flying over an operation in Syria, let's say?
I mean, it could. The experience of Afghanistan is that even when an awful lot of Canadian soldiers died, it doesn't. None of these incidents in itself changes or turns public opinion around on a dime. But it is interesting to see some indication of softening of support for the mission. It reminds me of something I've often said in other contexts, which is that it's the choice of political leaders that makes a consensus or that erodes a consensus. I mean, if Justin Trudeau had said that this mission was fine and we're all in, I don't think you would have seen this public opinion response. I mean, I've often told Federalist leaders in Quebec that if they would simply stop agreeing with the Parti Québécois, there'd be no Quebec consensus. We've seen a version of that here.
All right. Thank you very much, Associate Editor for Maclean's, Aaron Wherry, Maclean's Political Editor, Paul Wells, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.